Welcome to the Cold Steel Surgical Podcast with your hosts, Amir Farouk and Chad Ball.
We are delighted to bring you another Journal Club episode, this time with Dr. Nathan Ginther. Dr. Ginther is a colorectal surgeon at the University of Saskatchewan. And today he discusses his paper that was published in the Canadian Journal of Surgery entitled A Comparison of Perineal Stapled Prolapse Resection and the Altmaier Procedure at Two Canadian Academic Hospitals, with the first author being Haven Roy. And this was published in January of 2023. We use this article as a bit of a jumping off point to talk about rectal prolapse more in general. And again, one of our recurring themes and interests on the podcast, which is the introduction of new techniques and technologies. If you have any thoughts or concerns or questions or comments, we'd love to hear them at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or tweet at us at CanJSurge. Dr. Ginther, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cold Steel Podcast. This is another Journal Club episode. We're really excited to highlight your paper that was published in CJS earlier this year. So just for our listeners who may not know you as well as we do, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you practice, and maybe a little bit about what the impetus was to research this topic?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I practice colorectal surgery and a bit of general surgery, acute care, only as much as I have to. And I'm in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, or outside of the country. So it's an academic center. We have a residency training program. And until a couple of months ago, you know, there was a single site with colorectal special, their subspecialty care in Saskatoon. So we cover a population of, you know, approaching 1.3 million. So very busy colorectal wise. It's, you know, essentially 100% of the elective practices is in that domain. You know, I mean, I first came across the concept at one of those video abstract at the ASCRS meeting in 2015 or 2016, somewhere thereabouts. And I thought it was an interesting concept, you know, looking for innovative ways to expand sort of the scope of what we do, or at least creative ways of approaching the same problems if there is going to be an advantage. And so one thing that was pretty clear looking at some of those early videos was that technically speaking, it's a pretty straightforward approach to rectal prolapse. And I thought that maybe it may make it a bit more accessible to surgeons that otherwise might be a little bit uncomfortable. So that's sort of started that interest. And then also the time saving. So again, you know, we can tell that it's very efficient, and certainly in our current resource situations, not that that's that different now as compared to 5 years ago, but efficiency of operating time is really important. So those two things, in my mind, it was to increase efficiency, and then also potentially to increase the array of providers and surgeons that might be comfortable treating rectal prolapse.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense, Nathan. Can you give us, maybe for the uninitiated learners and guys like me who don't do this operation, can you give us a broad sense of how you frame potential repairs and how you look at those choices?
Yeah, so, you know, we really have perineal approaches and abdominal approaches. And in general, if our patients are young and fit and physiologically able to withstand, a general anesthetic and intra-abdominal surgery, then that should be the first approach. So, you know, the results for a transabdominal approach are superior. And, you know, by that I'm talking about primarily rectopexy. And, you know, if you haven't seen one of those, that's mobilization of the rectum, and we actually free it up much like you would for a resection, all the way down to the pelvic floor. And then once it's freed up, you'll do other tacks or sutures to fixate some of the peritoneum adjacent to the rectum onto the presacral fascia. So that's sort of the mainstay of abdominal approaches. You know, there's variations that can be combined with a resection of a redundant sigmoid, and, you know, and some practices that might be combined with some mesh to increase adhesion, but the mainstay of that is mobilization and then pexy with suture or tacks, and potentially mesh. And you know, it's sort of introduces the concept of a ventral mesh rectopexy, where we're where we're not mobilizing behind the rectum, but we're actually just dissecting, you know, along the rectovaginal septum and tacking a mesh to that, and then using that as a point of fixation and fixating the mesh to the presacral fascia. So, you know, abdominal approaches tend to be more successful with lower rates of recurrence, and so that's preferred if physiologically a patient can tolerate a GA. Most of those are done laparoscopically, at least in my practice. I've never done an open rectopexy, and we don't have a robotic practice here, so that's always laparoscopic, and, you know, results are excellent. And in fact, this is typically a day procedure, so I'm, you know, the right patient, I'm not even admitting these patients overnight. They're home the same day. But again, you know, and in the 80 to 90 to 100 plus year olds that we're seeing, that may not be very good. So we would prefer usually a perineal approach for somebody of advanced age or medical comorbidities. And that can be done almost always with a spinal anesthetic, good results. And the most successful treatments are resectional procedures where we're actually resecting the prolapsing and redundant segment and making a new anastomosis. That's where the two sort of perineal approaches that we talk about in our paper, the conventional Altmaier and the stapled prolapse resection or the stapled Altmaier, that's where those come in.
Can you just talk a little bit more in detail about the two common perineal approaches, including the stapled one, excluding the stapled one, which are the Altmaier and the DeLorme? Can you talk a little bit about those approaches just to sort of frame our discussion?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we'll start with the DeLorme's procedure. And the best way to conceptualize this is that really it's a sleeve resection of the mucosa. And then you're doing some plication of the underlying muscularis propria. So essentially, you know, the operation can be done in whatever position you're comfortable with. I do this all in prone position. It's just optimal positioning. You can see much better. Your assistant can be more useful. And then I'll put in some anal effacement sutures to get good visualization, or maybe a Lone Star retractor. And then you want to actually prolapse the rectum out. And I guess a first question would be, how do you select that? So what's an appropriate prolapse to treat with the DeLorme's procedure? And so that's either it's mucosa only, and so the redundant mucosa is prolapsing, but the muscularis is not, or short segment. So we 4 centimeters of prolapse as the cutoff. If it's longer than that, DeLorme's, interestingly, there is certainly some literature that it's, you know, that says it's pretty darn good, maybe almost as good as an Altmaier, even for longer segment prolapse. But most of us would consider it only for a short segment or for mucosa only prolapse. And so again, you want to prolapse it out to its maximal extent, and then usually inject some either just saline or some dilute epinephrine into the submucosa, and you're, you know, making a incision in the mucosa alone, just proximal to the dentate line, roughly a centimeter or 2 centimeters proximal to the dentate line. And then you access that submucosal plane and you strip the mucosa off, leaving the muscularis intact. And you bring that back as far as you can, or sort of to the apex of the prolapse segment. And once that's done, you use a plicating suture to imbricate the muscularis propria. And I would put in 4 of those sutures at each quadrant, or a total of 4, one in each quadrant. And when you tie them down, it bunches or reefs up that mucosa together, and then you can do a mucosal anastomosis. So it's just resecting the mucosa and then placating the underlying muscularis. So that would be the DeLorme's. And so the Altmaier is actually a resectional or full-thickness resectional procedure, and so you set it up in the same way. But instead of incising only the mucosa, you actually do a full-thickness rectotomy through the muscularis as well. And when you do that, you know, you see the mesorectum posteriorly and anteriorly, sort of, you know, nothing connected to tissue or the bare area. Then you have to dissect through the mesorectum and ligate or ligature or, you know, whatever device you want to use or method for control. And you want to get through all that perirectal tissue in the mesorectum onto the rectal wall itself. And then you just sort of pull it out and free it up from whatever mesentery there is. And you do that essentially as far as you can go. And you want to get to a point where you've removed all of the redundancy. And, you know, sometimes that's just the length of the prolapse, which you could see. And sometimes you actually, you know, get the sigmoid colon out and suddenly you've got a foot or 2 feet or, you know, sometimes a remarkable length. And then you resect that and you do an end-to-end anastomosis. And, you know, most of us would do a hand-sewn anastomosis there. You know, you can do it with staplers as well, but typically it'd be an end-to-end hand sewn anastomosis. And then once that's done, you drop everything back inside, and that's it. So typically, you know, we're looking at about 60 minutes or so of operating time for that, maybe a little longer. And our results are, you know, really, really very good. So those patients recover quickly, typically home in 2 or 3 days, and with a really low risk of major complications.
It's so well described. I wish I had that perfect description in my exams back in the day. You know, Nathan, you led a team and wrote a really, really nice paper in the CJS, as Amir mentioned. Can you start to walk us through that paper, maybe talking briefly about what the genesis of it was, why you decided to look at this, and then what you found in general and where it's taken you?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a pretty simple paper, and it's a retrospective, you know, cohort study, really. And like I mentioned at the start, you know, we wanted to explore some of the efficiency savings, and then also, you know, potentially ways to make this procedure accessible to general surgeons that might not be comfortable doing some of the other procedures. So essentially, we just had two groups, and we started to do the stapled approach, one of my colleagues and I. And you know, when you start doing new things, it's maybe a whole other topic about how you introduce new procedures or new technology. But I certainly feel a lot better doing that in combination with a colleague. You know, so we sort of two sets of eyes on a problem, and hopefully being able to avoid complications. And so we started. My colleague Dalip Gill and I started doing this at roughly the same time. And so prior to that, we were doing the conventional Altmaier procedure, and then we switched to the stapled Altmaier procedure fairly early on. And you know, we had a bit of a collaborative relationship with the colorectal group in Vancouver as well, who around the same time actually started to make some of the same changes. And so we ended up combining data after the fact. So essentially, we had two cohorts, and one was the historical controls, which were just consecutive patients. We went through our records and identified the patients that had Altmaiers and included them, and then we sort of the newer cohort with the stapled approach. And in general, you know, once we made the switch, we were almost always doing this stapled approach. Now, there were a few exclusions to that, and maybe we'll talk about some of the technical aspects a little bit later, but we didn't feel it was suitable necessarily for every patient. So we were still selective, and wasn't 100% change in technique. But anyway, you know, long and short of it is, over a period of about 2 years there, we accrued a total of 44 patients. And so 25 in the stapled group and 19 in the conventional group. Again, that's between the two sites. And so we went back afterwards and looked at our operative parameters and surgical outcomes, and you know what we found is that there was a lot of time saving. So the total time in the operating room was significantly reduced, and you know the operative time went from 67 minutes before to about an average of 30 minutes afterwards. So you know, 50% reduction in operative time. And then, you know, the perioperative anesthetic considerations didn't really change very much. And so that's sort of the nuts and bolts was this cohort series. And one of the other parameters we were interested in was cost. And I know we didn't really talk about that earlier, but one of the criticisms, I suppose, is that if we're adding a bunch of staplers to the procedure, that there may be increased cost to it. And that certainly is true, but that cost of staplers is more than offset by the cost savings of, you know, less time in the operating room. So, Amir, did you want to talk about the actual technical performance of the procedure? Do you want to discuss that a little later?
I just wanted you to just walk us through some of these tables, and then I do want to get to the how I do it part of this talk. So, you know, in your table one, you compare the standard Altmaier to your staple technique. It did seem like the patients that were going for the staple technique were a bit older, perhaps a little leaner, maybe a little bit frailer. Can you comment a little bit about that? Is that something that was you were deliberately thinking of when kind of starting this, or did it just sort of happen that way?
Yeah, I mean, there probably is a bit of a selection bias in that, you know, when you're looking at what's going to be the quickest way to get this patient off the operating table, then we would be more likely to choose a stapled approach. And so I guess by no surprise, that's typically the frailer, thinner, you know, patient. And so I think what we're seeing there in terms of the differences in the groups in terms of age and sort of markers of frailty is that we were probably choosing a stapled approach in the more frail patients specifically to minimize time in operating room for them.
And remind me, were these patients all under general anesthetic or do you ever do these under spinal or deep sedation?
Yeah, probably the majority. I mean, to be honest, like I don't know the Vancouver data here, but in Saskatoon, the majority are under spinal anesthetic. So unless there was a contraindication or a significant patient preference for GA, you know, I know some patients had aortic stenosis, which makes the anesthesia a little bit nervous about spinals. We would typically use a spinal, actually.
Yeah, I think that was typical, at least in my experience in Vancouver, where we used to do a lot of these operations at our ambulatory site, where you know, these patients would all essentially get a low-dose spinal or a caudal block. So that is a huge, obviously, advantage over our patients that need a general anesthetic for some of the other approaches that we talked about, like an abdominal approach. You can definitely see that there's a big difference in the operative time there in your table two, almost basically in half. And I think anybody who's tried to do an Altmaier or done some Altmaiers knows that it does take some time and you do have to be in the right plane. It does require some sense of like the anatomy. So yeah, it definitely seems to be a quicker and smoother operation from that point of view. That not a huge difference in the length of the pull-ups, it doesn't look like. And then talk to us a little bit about the recurrent, like this table three, which I think is really the money table in this study. Really not any significant change in complications, recurrence, or really anything else. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Have you noticed any major differences in terms of recurrences or any other issues between the two groups?
Yeah. So I think the key takeaway there is that our data replicates what was, you know, previously found, and that there is no difference in any major measurable outcome. So, you know, complication rates remain quite low, and most frequent complication is recurrence, which is what we expect given the patient. And, you know, our recurrence rates here, maybe a little on the high side of literature, but nothing that anybody who treats a lot of rectal prolapse would be surprised by. And sort of more perioperative outcomes or complications, the most common is urinary retention, which, you know, I mean, it's data, but I personally wouldn't consider that a meaningful complication. And differences, you know, in terms of bleeding that required intervention, it's actually really, really low. And our anastomotic leak rate was zero in the stapled group. And one in, you know, in the conventional group, which is sort of on par with the literature. But the key takeaways are that, you know, the things that we're interested in terms of major outcomes, complications, pelvic abscess, sepsis, death, you know, bleeding requiring intervention, there is no difference between them.
I think this is a great time to actually start talking about your approach to this operation from a technical point of view. So let me just pull up a video. It's not... your video, and I couldn't actually find the video from Dr. Karen Wooden, but I think this is a pretty representative kind of video that I found on YouTube. Maybe I'll let you do some commentary on it.
Sure. On the fly here, I haven't seen this video before.
Yeah. So let me just ask you, do you do this in lithotomy? I know you mentioned that you do your...
I do actually in prone, yeah. Yeah, I do
even stapled.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Certainly. Yeah. So you know, watching the video here, we're seeing them get set up to to bring the prolapse out to its maximal extent. One thing I'd say here is that I like to do something to actually efface the anus and sort of flatten the perineum a little bit more, so you can get a better view of that dentate line. And you know, it's one of our sort of critical landmarks is the dentate line. We want the resection to go to about 1 to 2 centimeters proximal to the dentate. And, you know, in this video, I'm sure if you're there, you can see it, but here, you know, you certainly can't. So I like to place either a Lone Star retractor or effacement sutures or something. But basically, you know, you want to get that prolapse out to its maximal extent and then get set up to do the first staple firing. And the first staplers that we're using are linear staplers, as you can see, you know, here, and those get fired at the 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock positions to sort of separate the prolapse into an anterior half and a posterior half.
And just to back up for a second, kind of glossed over it a little bit in terms of the workup of these patients as an outpatient, but I think one of the things that you mentioned in the paper is that you were pretty careful to exclude someone with an enteroseal. Can you talk a little bit to us about that? What do you mean by that? Why is that so important when you're thinking about this operation?
Right. Yeah. So, well, what we're talking about is, you know, with the low cul-de-sac and low anterior reflection, abdominal contents can come down into the pelvis and could actually conceivably be prolapsed out below the level of the pelvic floor and contained within or between the layers of the rectum. And if that happens, and I mean, small bowel would be the most likely organ, you know, and conceivably bladder could, you know, if it's a female patient had a hysterectomy, bladder potentially, but, you know, small bowel might actually reach down there. And if you're not aware of that and, you know, you do the stapled resection, you won't identify it and you could incorporate small bowel into your anastomosis, which could cause any number of complications, you know, perforation, sepsis, or enterorectal or enteroanal fistula, which would be a very, very significant complication if that happened. So, yeah, that's one of the things that we're most worried about. And, you know, the early literature, typically the authors would describe evaluation with MR depthography or something similar to that to exclude enteroseal. You know, I don't actually think that's necessary. I think that you can, with a good clinical examination, exclude that. And maybe part of it has to do actually with positioning. And so, you know, when I do this, like I said, in prone, there's always a little bit of Trendelenburg positioning too. And I think that actually serves to get any abdominal contents out of the pelvis. So just gravity is going to pull it up to the upper abdomen. And so even if there were to be an enteroseal in, you know, in upright positioning when there are patients on the operating table, that's less likely. And then I would do at the start of the case, when I'm deciding still which technique I'm going to do, it's a careful bi-digital examination. And again, most of our patients are female, so it's a simultaneous rectal and vaginal examination, trying to just to palpate to see what's the thickness of that space in the cul-de-sac, and if you get the sense that there's any additional tissue. And so, yeah, if I'm confident in that, then we'll proceed with the staple. But there's situations where I just can't feel, you know, adequately, and I'm not confident enough to exclude something else. And then I won't do the stapled approach. I'll do the conventional approach because you can directly visualize it. If there's small bowel in there, you know, you can see that and you can exclude it from the anastomosis.
Sort of on a related line, if someone has concomitant pelvic organ prolapse, you know, without they're having, you know, uterine prolapse or something like that through the vagina, is that someone that you would consider another approach? Does that change your approach? Or is, you know, if the rectal prolapse is really what's causing the most problems, that's what you're going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a bit of a complicated question. So you'd have to know a lot more about that patient. And so if this is a really frail elderly patient and the primary symptoms are from the rectal prolapse, then I'm going to focus on treating that, you know. I'm not going to be worried about a combined approach. Now, in younger patients or where there is significant symptoms from both, we actually do sometimes combined combined procedures as well, you know, with a gynecologist where we'll do, you know, a colpopexy or, you know, sacrocolpopexy in combination with rectopexy. But those will be done, you know, as a transabdominal approach, not as I've never done a simultaneous perineal approach for combined pelvic organ prolapse. You know, I probably would still, if there's no other reason to not do a stapled approach, provided the other genital or reproductive organ prolapse is not affecting the posterior wall of the vagina, it wouldn't really change things very much. So I think you could still do the same approach. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I just raise it just because I think it is important to kind of think about the whole picture when seeing someone in clinic. Like, that part of it is important, as the majority of these patients are female. And so I think getting a sense of, like, is there total pelvic organ kind of prolapses is important, because I think it would change your approach potentially if that was a big component of this as well. So yeah, I'm with you on that too. Okay, so maybe we'll just go back to the video here. So you got this linear stapler. Now, do you, just out of curiosity, do you use a certain staple height? Do you care if it's green or blue?
Yeah, you typically use the 100 millimeter green stapler, just because, you know, you're firing through two layers of bowel here, and the rectum is thicker than, you know, the small bowel or the colon in general. So it's fairly thick tissue, and, you know, there's also often some mesentery in there. So I typically use the green thicker firing loads. Now, you know, with availability being what it has been lately, we often don't have what we want. So I have done it with the blue loads as well, and it doesn't seem to make much difference. Maybe the reason for that is that everything you're stapling here, you know, as these as they're doing right now in the video, all that staple line is being completely excised. So maybe it's a bit thick and you wouldn't trust it for an actual anastomosis. That part is being resected. It's not forming the ultimate anastomosis. Like, you can really, it probably doesn't matter.
I must say, I usually, the way I've seen this, the way I would do this, I would do this one at a time. I feel like they would get in the way of each other.
Yeah. And not to mention, you're using two separate firings, which is probably two separate staplers.
Cost
perspective is unnecessary. Yeah. So what we see here is, you know, they've fired those two staplers, and that prolapse is now sort of split in half, and you've got an anterior leaf and a posterior leaf. And sort of the apex of that staple line should be up at the, you know, that 1 to 2 centimeters away from the dentate. And then there's the next firing is transversely, and this is actually performing the resection and doing the anastomosis simultaneously. Now, you know, in this video, they're using the same linear stapler, which, you know, I certainly have seen done, and I've never done that myself. We use a curved stapler, just tends to, has a nicer appearance to the, you know, end up with a circular anastomosis at the end. And, you know, we use the contour. I don't have any brand loyalty here, but it's a nice stapler. You know, it's really robust. And, again, because you're stapling through two layers of bowel and mesentery, you know, you really got to trust that those staples are robust and strong enough to do what you're asking. And so, you know, for that reason, I like the contour, but I don't have any, I guess, no specific reason to disagree with the use of a linear stapler for this firing.
Some of the boys and girls in Vancouver would certainly kind of get a feel of the rectum itself and kind of make a qualitative assessment about the thickness of the rectum. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they would say, I think it's too thick. Is that something that you ever run into or not?
Yeah. Yet? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we would make that assessment before this stage in the video. You know, at this point, you're pretty much committed to that technique. But the answer is yes. So when it's prolapsed out, and, you know, that's kind of, I didn't mention it, but I was mentioning when I was describing excluding or trying to exclude enteroceal, part of that assessment too is, you know, just the thickness of the tissue. And yeah, there's certainly been a handful of times, and I just think it's too thick, and I don't trust the staplers to do it. And, you know, that's, you know, the conventional approach. So I think it's, you know, I'd mentioned perhaps this being accessible to, you know, to non-subspecialist surgeons, but I guess one argument against that is if you have to make a change in plans and you don't know how to do an alternative technique, it's a pretty uncomfortable position to be in.
So, and you mentioned that you kind of efface the anus, so you can make sure your staples are actually going above the dentate line, or yeah, like not down to the dentate line. Can you talk a little bit about that assessment? Where do you actually want the staple line to be relative to the dentate line, and why is that important?
Yeah. So you want it to be at least 1 to 2 centimeters proximal to the dentate line. And, you know, I mean, that's just in a conventional Altmeyer, that's the margin that we select. And the reasons for that are twofold. And, you know, with staplers that are going to be there probably, you know, for the rest of the patient's life, if you have those staples at the dentate line, well, I mean, for one, you're excising part of the internal sphincter, and, you know, worsening sphincter function would probably result because you've resected part of it. But the other big concern would be pain. And so staples that cross the dentate line where there's visceral or somatic pain could subject that patient to potentially permanent long-term pain from that. And then, in my mind too, the risk of recurrence is moderate with any of these prolapse procedures. And so I'm always thinking, well, what about the next time? And if I have to do this again, what am I going to do? You know, if I'm too close to the dentate line, then I won't have anywhere to anastomosis in the next go round. And so I want to save enough landing zone if I have to do another resection in the future that I've still got something to anastomosis.
And do you do any other sutures or anything like that to oversew any of the staple lines?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah. So kind of when I, when we do that first linear staple line and I'll right at the apex of that, I'll use usually like an O or a 2O vicryl and I'll just pick up a big bite of that of the apex of the staple line and use that as an anchor. And, largely because I don't want this to retract spontaneously and lose control of it. But then I also use that and I'll overrun the entire contour staple line, so doing a full thickness overrun down that. And maybe I'm just paranoid, but I like adding some suture to that for hemostasis and just to get more tissue into the anastomosis.
Yeah, I find sometimes the corners of the staple line bleed, like right, not so much the contour green one, but right in the corner of the contour and the linear stapler, sometimes those corners tend to bleed, maybe because there's a lot of tissue that you kind of bunched up and resected there. And so sometimes I find that certainly the crew in Vancouver would often put a suture in those corners if it was bleeding.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And that staple line, you get these sort of intersecting staple lines, and sometimes it's a little bit ragged. You know, you can get kind of a zigzag there, and I just don't like that. And so I oversew that. But yeah, like I said, I actually do overrun the entire thing for a sleep at night stitch, if you will.
I got it. And when you're checking this at the end, is there anything that you're kind of like going through in your mind just to make sure that it looks a certain way? Is there anything that's made you stop and change your approach entirely, like convert to a more standard Altmaier, or never really run into a problem or a scenario like that?
Yeah, I actually haven't run into anything like that. And at this point, you've pretty much committed to this approach. And then if there's technical issues, you're looking at just doing directed repair of whatever that area of concern is. It'd be pretty tough now to re-prolapse everything and convert it entirely to a conventional approach. So mostly what I'm looking at is hemostasis. We'll put a scope in and we'll visualize it to make sure there's no big gaps in the anastomosis. But that part you've seen before, you kind of reduce back into the pelvis. But I still will put an anoscope in and have a good look at it and then make sure it's hemostatic. And some of the worst complications I've seen from Altmaier's have been hemorrhage related. So I think it's good to be paranoid about that and have a look. And, partly because when you've had it on tension, you've had the prolapse outside of the body, maybe even putting some pressure on blood vessels, and now that it's into anatomic position, they're free to start bleeding. So it's a good idea to look, I think, once it's actually reduced pelvis.
Yeah, I think that's very wise words. It's not fun to have to deal with a whole bunch of bleeding in your face. So no fun at all in this position. Anything that you do from like a dressing perspective, post-operative care, are you keeping these patients in the hospital or is this a day procedure for you? How do you kind of manage that perioperative care?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I do, and everybody has a slightly different approach to this. But these patients are admitted, and largely because they're typically frail. And so average length of stay is 2 days, sometimes three. And often it's not for physiological reasons that they're staying, it's more for social reasons. But so I leave the catheter in for the first night and then take that out day one, make sure your night function is adequate. I feed the patients right away and no prophylactic antibiotics or anything like that after they've left the operating room. And so it's a regular diet. It's catheter out day one. When they're eating and drinking well and have had a normal bowel movement, then they go home. And that's typically the second or maybe third post-operative day.
stool softeners or anything like that, milk and magnesium?
Yeah, I don't actually. I know one of my colleagues does routinely put everybody on PEG or, you know, milk of magnesia or something. I haven't found any sort of delayed return of bowel function without routine use of stimulants or laxatives. So I think there's no, between myself and my colleague who vary in that practice, there's really no difference in time in hospital.
Yeah, it probably tells you that probably a lot of our things that we do are probably just dog blend and we don't really, probably don't need them. I think it's very clear that these prolapse repairs all have a recurrence rate, whether you do them abdominal, perineal. And I know in the paper you mentioned that over the study period, there weren't any recurrences that were noted. If someone was going to have a recurrence, and I must say I did actually have someone in Vancouver when I was there doing my fellowship who did have a recurrence after one of these stapled repairs that was significant enough that needed another operation. How would you approach dealing with a recurrence of their prolapse after having a stapled repair like this?
Yeah, a good question. And so, you know, I guess the critical question is, can you repeat the same approach or have you burned a bridge, you know? I've only ever done a conventional Altmaier as a salvage operation. And largely it's just because my concern about too many staples and, perhaps interference of the existing staples if you were to redo a stapled approach. And so in those cases, and yes, it has happened to me, I would do a conventional Altmaier.
Why do you think this hasn't caught on more? It's certainly like a pretty easy thing to learn, I would say. Like it's much easier to learn how to do this than to do an Altmaier, certainly a DeLorme. I don't know about you, but I find DeLorme's incredibly kind of finicky to get, you know, just perfect with that mucosal resection, at least in my hands. Why do you think this hasn't caught on more, and do you think that it's something that is going to be more popular as time goes on?
Yeah, I mean, it's new for one, right? And so people are, I think we're always afraid to integrate new things, partly because of some of the liability issues or the criticism issues. You're doing something new. If it's different than what your colleagues are doing or what common practice is, you're potentially going to be more criticized for that. So part of it may be just fear of deviating from the practice standard. I guess I would say that in general, less comfort with subspecialty procedures, at least in newer general surgery trainees. And so, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't have a lot of residents now that I think you're going to be comfortable treating rectal prolapse as a general surgeon. And so, you know, why are they going? Why do they want to dabble, you know, in rectal prolapse? So I guess part of this is concentration in the hands of subspecialists rather than generalists. And yeah, the other aspect, I mean, maybe a third element too, is just, I mean, there's not a lot of discussion about this, you know, like unless you go to these meetings and you watch these videos or you really seek this out, how are you going to know about it, right? And so maybe that's, you know, where venues like this dissemination of information might have a role. But I think that's how I would describe it.
And you mentioned that when you were introducing this approach that you did it together with Dilip in conjunction and kind of, I'm sure, doubled up on your cases when you're kind of getting over your initial experience. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about how your group approaches innovation and when you think and you see a new procedure, how do you actually go about integrating it into your practice? Because, you know, we all see these videos, especially now, like it's an amazing time to be a surgeon, because you can literally, like, one of my favorite things to do, honestly, like it's like my enjoyment at nighttime, is to go on Sages, the Sages Facebook colorectal group, and like watch people's videos that they post and of the crazy, you know, like the Hartman's reversal and a patient's had a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. Like, you know, how do you approach that? I guess what I'm saying is, like, in an era where you can watch videos and see things and go to meetings and like people are showing you, oh yeah, I did the next greatest and latest thing, How do you figure out, well, you know, this is a technique that I think actually is going to have some promise. And then more importantly, how do you go about integrating that into your practice in a safe way?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, from just sort of vague philosophical grounds here, you know, recognition of your own limitations, right? And not being, perhaps being humble, right? So not just assuming because you've seen something that you can do it or that you necessarily should do it, you know? And so I think just an honest look at yourself and your practice, and is this something that is actually going to add to my patients or not? And then, you know, realizing what's in scope of practice and what isn't. And I think we should all actually, you know, be emboldened to add to our skill set for those things that are within scope of practice, right? And it's not a huge leap. You know, we're not talking about, I mean, I'm a pelvic surgeon. Adding new pelvic procedures is not a big leap, right? Even if it's things I wasn't trained on, that's very different than me trying to do, you know, whatever, a thyroidectomy or something, appendectomy or something like that, right? So I can be a lot more confident adding things that are within the scope of my everyday practice. And that's going to vary from, you know, surgeon to surgeon. So I think part of that is that in terms of how you integrate those things, for me, it's just making sure that there actually is some good quality, durable data, right? That it's not just, you know, it's just not the flavor of the month. That'd be a part of it. And the second is, you know, I kind of alluded to it, but in our practice, there's sort of three things that we've added in terms of technical skill sets, and that's TATME and lateral pelvic lymph node dissections, and then expanding role for transanal endoscopic microsurgery. And so sort of myself and my colleagues, the way we've approached that is doing everything as a team approach, right? And so case review, sort of a consensus, and within the practice, we have, you know, daily discussions about patients and cases and making sure there is agreement and consensus on whatever this thing, be it, you know, lateral lymph node dissection, is appropriate. And then making sure we do adequate sort of self-study and reflection on those, on whatever that skill set is. And as you pointed out, there's just a ton of resources, right? You can learn a lot. But when we're implementing that, is actually doing it all in team surgery, right? And so sometimes that means involving, you know, mentors or proctors, and, you know, like we've had done cases with urologists who, for example, do a lot of pelvic lymph node dissections, which wasn't something that we were doing. So, you know, spend some time with the urologist, watching what they do and learning what they do, and then integrating that over. So, and I think that's how I would approach, at least, you know, what we've done here in Saskatoon.
Well, once again, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great discussion. I think a lot of people are really going to benefit from it. So thank you again.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for the invite. Thanks for your time tonight.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, and feedback, so send us an email at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or tweet at us at CanJSurge. Thanks again.